Moisturizer from Jergens. It's a lotion that works with water to instantly lock in moisture from my shower. My skin stays soft and luminous all day without a heavy, sticky feel. It's all-day moisture made simple.
Well, I did always teach you to enjoy the simple things in life. Can I borrow your Jergens Wet Skin Moisturizer?
Of course, Mom. You're more than just a pretty face. Jergens.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler Weather Radar Forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
We're looking at a temperature of 42 degrees and really nice weather today. But we've got some crazy weather this week, starting tonight with some showers after midnight, and we're looking at a temperature of 36. We're going to be looking at a cloudy day tomorrow. We'll have periods of rain. The high's about 47, and that will last into tomorrow night. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490. WGZH.
Around the House with Steve Gladstone on Saturday mornings from 8 to 10 is jam-packed with important information, preventative maintenance, and all sorts of home tips to keep your house in great shape and your family safe. We have special guests on heating, cooling, environmental issues, and we make it fun with trivia contests and prizes. Don't let that home fall apart around you. Join us Saturday mornings from 8 to 10 on Around the House with Steve Gladstone on 1490 WGCH.
The U.S. economy has been getting stronger, and home values have been increasing. Hi, I'm Jay Farner, president of Quicken Loans. Many of our clients have been taking cash out of their homes, a strategy that might work for you. The smart move is for you to refinance your mortgage right now with Quicken Loans. The rate today on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.18%, APR 4.35%. Call 800-QUICKEN or go to quickenloans.com. That's 800-QUICKEN.
Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Welcome to Staples.
Staples guy. This year I'm preparing my own taxes.
Good for you.
Yep, I'm going to be accountable.
Right. Well, Staples can help with storage and filing supplies, plus software like QuickBooks and TurboTax.
Go on. You have my interest.
And now get TurboTax for up to $15 off at Staples.
Up to 15 bucks off TurboTax? That'll pay handsome. Returns.
Right.
Thanks, Staples guy. Depreciate it.
Uh-huh.
Everything you need this tax season for less, like up to $15 off TurboTax. Staples, make more happen.
In-store only, it's 4117.
Allergy sufferers are hearing a lot of numbers these days about symptoms and relief. But the number sufferers want most is zero, as in zero nasal allergy symptoms. And nothing gets you closer to zero than Nasacort. Because unlike antihistamines that stop only one cause of your allergy symptoms, Nasacort stops more. And stopping more gets you closer to zero. For 24-hour relief of your worst nasal allergy symptoms, including congestion, choose Nasacort. It stops more of what makes you miserable. Use as directed.
The opinions expressed in our talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio. Now, the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on 1490 WGCH.
Good afternoon, Greenwich. This is Beth O'Malley, and I am here today with not just one guest, but three guests. We're very excited to discuss Lyme disease today. This is part of the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on WGCH 1490 or WGCH.com from anywhere. And today's guests are Dr. Ilana Frid. She is a New York City autoimmune neurologist specializing in the diagnosis and treatment strategies of infections-induced autoimmune disorders. Welcome, Dr. Frid.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. We're so glad that you could join us today. We also have Jennifer Reed, and Jennifer is the director of the Ridgefield Health Department BLAST Tick-Borne Disease Prevention Program. And welcome, Jennifer.
Glad to be here, Beth. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. And I should mention that while you're based in Ridgefield, you do quite a bit of work here in Greenwich as well as part of BLAST.
Yes, all over Southern Connecticut.
Wonderful. And last but not least, I have our wonderful guest, who I have to thank so much, Andrea, for setting this up for us. Andrea McGillipin is the head of the school of the Lynx program in Stamford. It's a small private school, one-to-one, that is part of the Greenwich Educational Group. And I'm going to have you discuss a little bit more about the Lynx program today. Welcome, and I'm glad you're here.
Great. Thank you for having me, Beth.
Absolutely. So tomorrow is a big day for the three of you in that you will be doing a presentation here in the community. And I wondered, Andrea, if you could just speak to when and where that is so that our listeners could go tomorrow.
Great. So we are having a panel on Lyme and learning tomorrow with Dr. Fred, Jennifer Reed, myself, and two parent members in the Lyme world. It will be located at 78 Harvard Avenue, Suite 340 in Stamford, Connecticut, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m.
Okay, terrific. And the panel was really set up in order to inform the community about symptomology of Lyme disease as well as treatment?
Yeah, really what we've noticed in the last year and a half, we have gotten many students that have come to us with Lyme and really wanting to reach out and build a community for our parents and our families to educate them, to let them know how that we can support them and to provide them with a space where they can share their experiences and get questions that they want answers to.
Now, you are also a social worker like myself. We were both in the city for school. I was at Hunter and you at Columbia. And one of the most fascinating things about having your master's in social work is you really never know where that degree is going to take you in terms of your career. How long have you been at the Links program?
So I have been there for a year and a half.
Okay. And in terms of the school, can you just give our audience a sense of the student size and the population?
Sure. So Links Academy, we are an accredited one-to-one school, and we provide really customized services for a range of students with medical vulnerabilities, with emotional vulnerabilities, students that are just looking for a smaller classroom size or that need an opportunity to be successful in the classroom if their current placement hasn't worked. So we are rolling admission, and currently our student is at 18, and we continue to grow throughout the year. We are 12 months of the year.
And you really saw a need in your student base for further education because Lyme disease can sometimes show itself as emotional problems and go undiagnosed as Lyme disease, correct?
Exactly. And I think, you know, since, you know, the last year and a half, we started to see a lot more students that had Lyme, and it's amazing in a one-to-one, you are able to customize so much, but we felt that we still needed to learn more. So we had reached out to Jennifer Reed at the Lyme Connection to make sure that we were providing kind of the best and most appropriate education for our students in the classroom and also focusing on the social and emotional impact that it inevitably has on both the student and their families.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask Dr. Alana Frid to step in here and speak a bit about what you're seeing in terms of your work with both children and adults with complex cases of Lyme disease.
Sure. I'd like to first thank Jennifer and Andrea for actually recognizing what a tremendous public health issue this is and bringing this into the forefront and actually helping students and families navigate through this very complex process, both physically and emotionally for the child as well as the parents and the family. And so some of the things that I see in my practice, and I think the reason why we're having this conversation is because really Lyme disease is essentially defined by the CDC guidelines as someone who's having headaches, fevers, joint aches, perhaps some fatigue and a rash. But that is a very small subset of what Lyme disease really is and what I see in my practice. And a lot of the patients really struggle neurocognitively, which means that they have a lot of neurologic and psychiatric manifestations, which is really what the debilitating aspect of Lyme disease is and why these children require extra attention and why many adults are on disability for this disorder.
You know, as a clinician, my experience is that it's very hard to tell the difference at times between a depressive, anxiety, or bipolar disorder versus a symptom of Lyme disease. And that's where the medical expertise really comes in and when I'll make a referral.
Sure, yes. I hear that a lot, actually, from patients. And so the way to identify that, or the way I identify that in my practice, is I patients have to get tested, which includes blood work. It includes neurologic testing, which may entail an MRI of the head, perhaps a brain SPECT scan, which is a nuclear medicine study. Sometimes we require a lumbar puncture to often show evidence of an infection. A lot of times it is done in order to rule out other manifestations. And then one big aspect of my practice is history taking and physical exam findings. I often see subtle neurologic findings on physical exam in a patient who primarily presents with psychiatric complaints, such as anxiety or depression, but they will have aches and pains, and they will have things like insomnia and difficulty reading, trouble with their balance and not participating in sports. So when you obtain history and examine them, you start seeing other subtle things that you wouldn't just see in a patient who has anxiety. Additionally, their blood work, which often needs to be ordered through a specialty lab, because many of the regular labs that are ordered by a physician can be 50 to 70% times inaccurate or falsely negative, and therefore I often use specialty labs such as Igenix to identify Lyme disease in patients. So the other aspect of my practice is that I often look at them, at patient, and see, are they responding to medications that they should be responding to for a specific clinical complaint? Many times depression, or for example, in my practice, I see headaches frequently. Patients respond to one or two medications and they can go back to life and go back to work and school. But patients with Lyme disease who have an underlying infection and inflammation, they don't respond well to their medication, and that's when one should start looking for other causes of their underlying complaint.
And really what I'm hearing is that it's very hard. It creates great diagnostic confusion in terms of really pinpointing what the issue is.
That's correct, and that's why you want to see a doctor who is versed in Lyme disease if this is something that one suspects and lives in an endemic area, and the one who participates in high-risk activity, which I should actually address, and I'm sure that Andrea and Jennifer will touch on that as well, that high-risk activity doesn't necessarily mean hiking in the woods. It could be playing in your yard or on a playground or in a soccer field. It really depends on kind of where you live, the tick population in the area, and all of these things are important to kind of start physicians and patients thinking about what could be contributing to their symptoms.
Absolutely. I have a friend who contracted Lyme disease and had the rash and so forth, just simply playing golf here in Greenwich.
Right.
And I remember years and years ago, my daughter was at camp out in the Audubon Society at in the marshlands, and she came home within a day. She had one of those bullet point rashes with this big circle around it of red, and I rushed her right over to the doctors. Can you describe for our listeners what the rash looks like and what the tick looks like? Because despite how many years there's been education out there, I find that people will say, oh, I saw one of those big ticks, I have to go get checked for Lyme disease. And my understanding is it's not the large ones that we're worried about.
Right. I'm so glad you're bringing up the rash. Thank you for this. So let me touch on the rash first. It's a big misnomer that people have to have a rash in order to be diagnosed and have Lyme disease. Actually, only 20% of patients will present with a rash, and 7% of those will have the bullseye rash, where you have the cleared center and then the red rings around it. A lot of times, the rash can be very esoteric. It doesn't really look like much and doesn't look like a bullseye at all. And even if you go to your doctor or a dermatologist, they may often misdiagnose the rash for being the Lyme-related outbreak. In terms of the tick itself, a lot of times they are super tiny and very difficult to catch them. And a lot of times people will note because that they actually have a tick on them when it feeds and grows in size and becomes embedded. That's when they start feeling the tick. They could be poppy seed size, which is the nymphs. And these are the ones that are out kind of during the summer, and they're the ones who believe to carry the Lyme bacteria and be infected the most. But I do have to say that we've had cases of patients who contract Lyme disease not just from ticks, and it could be from fleas and spider bites. So when people are not feeling well, and they go to their physician, and their workup looks fine, and their blood work looks okay, and they keep feeling like they're not themselves. Something is wrong. I think this diagnosis should be a consideration, especially in the tri-state area. But I have to mention that really Lyme has been reported in all 50 states and in 80 countries around the world. So it's something that we should start thinking of first, not last, when people have been tested for other common diseases and have come back negative.
Okay, thank you so much. What there are, back in the day, I don't believe that there were tests that were truly reliable, but it sounds like what you're saying is that there are reliable tests today for tick-borne diseases. Is that correct?
The tests are still an issue. There are some tests that are a little bit more reliable than they were in the past, and as I mentioned, I specifically use specialty laboratories that have to be ordered specifically for Lyme testing and some co-infections. I use Igenix testing, Galaxy, as well as Advanced Labs. That's typically not ordered by your bread and butter internal medicine doctor or pediatrician, although some of them do know about it and do order these testing. But these tests are typically are more well known by what we call Lyme literate doctors. So physicians who have been part of ILADS or do a lot of work in the Lyme community would definitely know about these tests specifically.
Okay, terrific. And you just touched on my next question, which is that as far as I'm aware, there are other tick-borne diseases beyond Lyme disease. Is that correct?
That is accurate. I actually tell my patients that it's unusual to catch just Lyme disease from an insect bite. Typically, in my practice, my patients have anywhere from 3 to 5 infections at the same time. So Lyme disease and perhaps 2 to 4 other infections. And this is really where the chronic Lyme patients have a major issue, because their immune system is really insulted by more than just one infection. And additionally, they develop often these autoimmune phenomenon, which is what my specialty is, where essentially your immune system starts malfunctioning and attacking its own body. And that can happen with the nerves, it can happen with the brain and other organ systems. And additionally, a lot of the Lyme patients will also have a suppressed immune system. So not only that it's not functioning properly and affects your own organs, but it may also be low immune system, where it's not fighting off the common pathogen that we come in contact with every day the right way.
Is there a vaccine today for Lyme disease?
No, there is no vaccine. It was available in the early 2000s, but has been taken off the market, and nothing's available right now.
Why was it taken off the market?
There are different reasons that people talk about. One of the reasons is that it wasn't... people didn't need it enough, so there wasn't enough need for the vaccine. There's other organizations who talk about the fact that it may have caused neurologic and autoimmune side effects that were not thought of initially, and that's why it was taken off the market, but it's not available today.
Okay. All right, thank you. What we're going to do is take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to be asking Ms. Jennifer Reed, the director of the Ridgefield Health Department's BLAST Tick-Borne Disease Prevention Program, which also works very closely here with the town of Greenwich, a bit more about what to do when you find a family member, yourself, a child, has symptoms that you're concerned about. Who do you reach out to? We have, you know, Dr. Elena Fritta is an incredible resource to us, but sometimes parents don't know what professionals they really should turn to. So we'll be addressing that as soon as we get back. I'm going to take just a brief break, and this is Beth O'Malley at Be Well with Beth, part of the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour, WGCH 1490.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather radar forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
We're looking at a temperature of 42 degrees and really nice weather today. But we've got some crazy weather this week, starting tonight with some showers after midnight, and we're looking at a temperature of 36. We're going to be looking at a cloudy day tomorrow. We'll have periods of rain. The high is about 47, and that will last into tomorrow night. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490. WGZH.
This is Margaret Walsh of Greenwich Library. The end of summer hours at the library signals the return of one of our most popular programs, the Friends Friday film series. Started back in the 1950s, the film series featured movies once a month. Former Greenwich Library film librarian Wayne Campbell expanded this program in the 70s to a film every Friday. Although now retired from the library, Mr. Campbell continues to select the films and introduce each one with some fun facts and background information. The movie selections include blockbuster new releases, independent films, foreign films, and classics. Special selections are made to tie in with other library programs such as Greenwich Reads Together. The screenings take place in the library's Cole Auditorium. Showtime is always 8 p.m. and doors open at 7:40 unless otherwise stated. There is no charge, and admission is open to all. I'm Margaret Walsh of Greenwich Library on 1490 WGCH.
Welcome back, Greenwich. This is Beth O'Malley at Be Well with Beth, part of the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour at WGCH 1490 or WGCH.com from anywhere. We are here today with three experts on Lyme disease, and it's so nice to have you guys here because living in Connecticut now for about 12 years, I know more people since I moved here to Connecticut than I ever did before in terms of Lyme disease. And I've lived in Seattle, Arizona, D.C., but it seems that here is really where, and it may be that it's the Northeast, I'm not sure, but it does seem that there's quite a bit of Lyme disease diagnosed here. And so as I'm saying that out loud, I'm thinking to myself, where did Lyme disease begin? And would it be here in Connecticut?
Yes, Beth. Lyme was actually first discovered here in 1975 in Lyme, Connecticut. That's where the name comes from. An observant mom noticed that children in Lyme were showing signs of arthritic symptoms, and she had a background in biology. She took notes, kept track, and really reported to the state that she saw a new illness emerging, she felt. And sure enough, the Department of Health and researchers dug into it, and Polly Murray had spotted a new illness to America. It was in Europe years before, but an observant mom
Definitely. Is that right? So is it named after the town of Lyme?
Yes, it is. It's named after Lyme.
Okay. All right. Well, that makes sense. In terms of where do we go? If we start, like I have a 17-year-old and a 13-year-old child. If I start to be concerned that there might be something more going on with the possibility of Lyme disease, what's typically the first thing that I would do would be to pick up the phone and call my pediatrician. But from there, what would you recommend?
Well, I think when we talk about Lyme disease or any of the tick-borne diseases, you really have two scenarios to follow. If you had a rash, as you mentioned, it's usually a very quick and easy diagnosis to determine that this child has Lyme disease. If, as a parent, you're just noticing, or as a teacher or a family friend, noticing symptoms developing that are a little bit vaguer, but the ones that Dr. Frid mentioned, where you might have a young person who's experiencing joint pain, fatigue, not themselves, really some changes in personality that concern you, you certainly might discuss this with a therapist. You might discuss it with the pediatrician. But in Connecticut, we would really recommend that parents do consider the possibility of Lyme disease being an underlying cause. And that can, if it's gotten to an advanced stage, really require seeing someone who has some advanced training in Lyme disease. And that can be an internal medicine doctor with Lyme training. It could be a neurologist, as Dr. Frid mentioned. That is a specialty of hers. But it isn't always as easy as one might think to find the right route to take.
And, you know, here in Connecticut, we have so many resources available to us. I know that you've been a longstanding member of the Western Connecticut Council of Government's Tick-Borne Disease Task Force, and that's a planning organization that represents municipalities both in Western and Southern Connecticut, and that you've also been actively involved in research, community-based prevention research, you know, education, and also patient support.
Yes, I've been involved with Lyme disease, I would say, questions and answer seeking since about 1999. I began as a parent, and after my children were diagnosed, realized I was also a patient. So it began on a very personal level, Beth, and I watched what my family went through and met other parents along the way. And one, Karen Gaudian, joined with me and formed the Richfield Lyme Disease Task Force at the time. That was the name, with the blessing of our first selectman, Rudy Marconi, in Richfield. We began this task force in 2003 and then really just set out to fill different needs. Now this task force is called Lyme Connection. I was a co-chair until 2016 with Karen. And we really looked at what we had needed as parents, what people were telling us they needed, and tried to fill that gap by starting support groups, by having a website with information, putting on seminars. One of the biggest things is a very large event that's free at Western Connecticut State University every May. So really just filling the gap. I had the good fortune then of working on a grant that Governor Rell was offering in 2008 to health departments in Fairfield County. And we developed the BLAST program as a prevention and early symptom program. And so now if you looked on the Richfield website, you would find two entities, the BLAST prevention program as part of the health department and Lyme Connection as a town committee with patient support resources. So I've worn both hats over the years. My primary focus right now is the BLAST prevention and early symptom detection program, but I certainly understand all of the needs that parents and families have when tick-borne diseases impact them.
And again, those resources are available to all of us here in Connecticut. The website for that would be www.lymeconnection.org.
Yes, on the lymeconnection.org website, you would find out about the Richfield support groups. There are 2 every month in the evening, second and fourth Thursdays, 5 to 7 p.m., always free. You would find out about the seminars and also things around the state. We do our best on that website to post whatever is happening throughout the state and beyond, actually. We have websites. We get calls from folks in New Jersey and New York. I can tell you, actually, as the organization has grown and our work has grown, we get emails and phone calls from not just around the country but around the world, people seeking answers for these problems. We also run, in the fall, a professional conference for mental health practitioners, again, free, in conjunction with the Lear Foundation, where psychiatrists, social workers, and therapists can come and learn from the professionals in a very lovely retreat setting about the ways that tick-borne diseases impact the brain, because it's really a new emerging area. And as Dr. Frid mentioned, you know, this is something where neurologists, psychiatrists, therapists are really struggling to tease apart what's going on. And when a tick-borne infection is at the root of behavioral or learning problems, and you can treat it and resolve a young person's problems, what a benefit to know that there can be an end to these problems. And that's what we'll be talking about at Links tomorrow night, that when it's a medical-based behavioral or learning problem, if good treatment can solve this family's suffering, it's really such a blessing.
It's so incredible. And, you know, just it is newer information for me that learning disabilities and behavioral issues, as well as mood disorders, all three of those can be symptoms of Lyme disease, which is just fascinating for not just for physicians and mental health providers, but also for educators, and thus, you know, the link to Greenwich Education Group, and how this presentation tomorrow came to be. Now, for myself and some of my buddies who are therapists who are listening today, where is this lovely place that we can go to take the workshops?
Yes, well, we will have the information on the Lyme Connection website. It is in Ridgefield, and I believe this fall will be the 6th annual conference, and we would love to have everyone come. So it does require registration because it's limited to 50 participants, but
okay,
always free.
All right. I'll get me and my buddies up there quick. Tell me, there's also www.blastlyme.org. So BLASTLYME.org. And that is a site that is available that is helpful in learning effective ways for people to avoid getting tick bites.
Yes, blastlyme.org is part of the Ridgefield Health Department, and it's a program now that's funded by the Western Connecticut Council of Governments, which is an area that extends from Sherman through Greenwich and up into the Westport area. And these mayors and selectmen in the towns I'm in that geographic area have recognized what an important problem this is and want the BLAST message to be spread. And BLAST covers not only prevention but early symptom identification. With the program, the message, BLAST, is an acronym, and we go out into the community and explain to everyone that these five simple BLAST points are really the most effective things you can do to keep your family safe. The BLAST points that we recommend were identified in a research project that was done at Yale and published, I believe, in 2008. We were fortunate to have one of the authors live in Ridgefield, Dr. Anita Connolly. She's remained as our scientific advisor, and she shared the findings with us even, I believe, before they were published. And so they are the basis of what we recommend to people. The B is to bathe or shower after outdoor activity. The L is to look for ticks and rashes on yourself daily and remove them properly. The A is to apply repellents. There are different types for your skin and for your clothing. The S is to spray tick habitat in the yard. And the T is to treat pets with appropriate products, speaking with your veterinarian, and know that ticks do shift from host to host, so you have to be careful. And it's so important to know that you don't have to go far to encounter a tick. They will feed on anyone, human or animal. They will be right out there in your backyard. They love the Pachycendra, the messy leaf litter, the yard edge, the stone walls when you are in a damp, moist area, and really most of the habitat we have in our beautiful state.
That's why I'm making a face, because you just described my yard.
I know, and that's one of the good reasons why there's an abundance of deer ticks. It's the deer tick that we're talking about. So
when I see the guys in the morning, the baby deer and the mommy deer running through my yard, those are the parts of my yard I should avoid, or all of the yard?
Absolutely. You want to avoid wherever you see ticks standing, which is generally that edge of the yard. Mm-hmm. That is where, between lawn and woods, where you'll find most of the ticks. But know that they hitch a ride on the deer and they mate on the deer, but it's really the rodents that they get the infection from, and that the rodents carry most of these ticks, transport them around the yard. So places where the rodents go, where you're little mice and chipmunks are, squirrels, your Pachycendra, they love to live in your stone walls. They will be under the barberry bushes. These are all places that you need to be careful of. And if you do have your yard sprayed, to have those areas sprayed. I always say, when you're playing golf, you don't have to worry. When you go off the course to hunt for a ball, that's when you're in jeopardy.
Yeah.
It's not the players on a soccer field. It's the little ones, the parents aren't watching, that are rumbling around in the yard edge. They're the soccer field. So those are the spots you have to worry about.
Okay, great. Thank you. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll tell you where in my home. And it's one of these embarrassing things that I hate to even share on the air, but the more I talk to other local folks who are homeowners, we all have the same little dilemma with these rodents. So we'll be right back to discuss that. There may be one other place that we shouldn't be hanging out or washing and bathing afterwards, at least to take precautions. So this is Beth O'Malley at Be Well with Beth, part of the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour at WGCH 1490 or WGCH.com from anywhere.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather radar forecast. WGCH brings you up-to-the-minute weather 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
We're looking at a temperature of 42 degrees and really nice weather today. But we've got some crazy weather this week, starting tonight with some showers after midnight. And we're looking at a temperature of 36. We're going to be looking at a cloudy day tomorrow. We'll have periods of rain. The high is about 47, and that will last into tomorrow night. This is meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans for 1490. WGCH.
Greenwich, you need sports talk. I mean, WGCH really needs sports talk. Rob Adams, that's me, and Paul Silverfarb bring you a doubleheader Monday through Friday from 3 to 4. In conjunction with the Greenwich Sentinel, we're your source for high schools, pro sports, and all sports. Got a story? Want to talk? We've got the outlet for your sports needs. So join Paul and me for our doubleheader weekdays from 3 to 4 right here on 1490 WGCH and WGCH.com anywhere.
Hi, this is Beth O'Malley at Be Well with Beth, part of the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour here at WGCH 1490 or WGCH.com from anywhere. And we are here this afternoon with three experts on Lyme disease. Dr. Elena Fritz from New York City, who is an autoimmune neurologist specializing in the autoimmune disorders, both diagnosis and treatment, as well as Jennifer Reed, who works in Ridgefield at the Ridgefield Lyme Disease Task Force, Lyme Connection, and works with the BLAST program, as well as Andrea. And Andrea is here locally at Greenwich Education Group as the headmaster at the Lynx School, a school right here in Stamford. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about the impact on students, on children with Lyme disease, what that can look like and feel like at school even after a diagnosis, the impact on self-esteem, of course, of carrying a medical diagnosis, and how that might have an impact on either the ability to engage with sports or to engage even with friends or even to show up for school that day, depending on how one is feeling medically. Just as we were letting off, I was saying there was a place in my
home where I have a huge problem and I need to watch for ticks. And at first, I didn't want to tell anyone when I realized that I had some mice in my garage. But then I found out from talking to everybody else that apparently I'm not alone. We all have mice in our garage here. And I've called in the experts and they've sealed everything they can seal and they've put out traps and we've done everything we could do. Somehow or other, somebody's still in my garage. It's driving me up a wall. So I keep telling these little guys who are bringing me in acorns and flipping over my mouse traps and eating all the peanut butter off of the traps that I am out to get them. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize before that they could be carriers of the ticks, which is really good to know. All right. Dr. Frid, you're still here, yes?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I wanted to ask, earlier you spoke about some of the symptoms, and if you could speak a little more as to when you mentioned chronic Lyme, and I know there's so many symptoms, brain fog, dizziness, memory problems, but when we're talking about chronic, what are we looking at in terms of some of the more advanced symptoms of having Lyme disease?
Well, I think the most debilitating symptoms for patients are neurocognitive and neuropsychiatric, as well as some physical symptoms. Debilitating fatigue is one of them, which can be waxing and waning. And I actually didn't want to leave the show without informing your listeners, especially in children and in adults as well, that these symptoms can be coming and going. And so sometimes it's very difficult for parents to believe their children because of one minute they complain that everything's bad and they can't get off their bed, for example, when they have to go to school in the morning. However, if you stay at home with them, a half an hour later, they're jumping up and down or watching TV and there's no problem. It's not that the child is making things up. It's because the symptoms can come and go. The fatigue, as I mentioned, can be very debilitating. They can also have intermittent, which means occasional pains. They can have issues with kind of coordination and playing sport activities. That could be a big problem. Another big issue that is going to be very difficult to ascertain for many adults and parents, as well as actually physicians, is reading issues. And you won't hear it from patients and from kids specifically without asking them. And when they do share with you, they will tell you things like, I can't concentrate, the words are jumping around. And if you examine them neurologically, you will see that they have abnormal eye movements, which talks to the fact that they have brain inflammation from the infection or from the autoimmune issue. A lot of the symptoms, as we mentioned, could be memory problems. At the onset of my practice, I would get patients who are in their late 20s and early 30s who would come complaining of memory issues, and they would say, oh, it's just because I'm getting older, I thought it was normal. I'll tell you that it's not normal to have memory issues at any age. And, you know, I saw a patient today who's 88 years old. He doesn't have Lyme, but he's ahead of a company, so he's doing phenomenally well with his memory at 88. Therefore, a 12-year-old or a 30-year-old or a 60-year-old should not have memory issues. There's also a lot of neuropsychiatric issues, which is unexplained anxiety, anxiety over things that are, you know, don't make sense to people, where a child, for example, was very active and liked to be on stage all the time, now is fearful to leave their house. Regressive behavior, which is very common, and I see that less frequently in adults, although it does occur, but primarily in children. For example, I have a child who is 12 years old. When he comes to my waiting room, he sits and reads a 500-page novel on World War II for leisure, not for school. Then when I bring him into my office, he bounces around and keeps touching everything in the office, including paintings, including books on my desk. So this is hiding his face in his T-shirt. This is not normal behavior for a 12-year-old. So I always tell parents that you know your child more than anyone else. If you think that something is wrong, something is wrong, and you have to pursue it.
Absolutely. I love how you worded that, because that's what I see in my practice as well when parents come in, and sometimes, you know, for the same symptoms. And a parent knows a child more than anyone can know that child, other than the child knowing themselves. And it's just fascinating how many times a parent really already has the answers, but then goes through all of the necessary testing and so forth. I wanted to ask Andrea to speak a little bit to what you see at the school with that, with the symptoms coming and going.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of what Dr. Frid is exactly what we're seeing. You know, we see students that will come in and be very inattentive, sometimes mask itself even as avoidant behavior. They're taking a lot of breaks during class, or they're struggling to get out of their house and their parents are getting frustrated. So sometimes we might not even figure out what's going on for a little
bit, right?
But I also think it's important to recognize kind of the quick change. We might have a student that comes in that has a great day, a great week, a great month, and we think, yes, we're on the right track. And then the very next day, they're kind of out for the count, and we might not see them for 2 days, a couple weeks. And it's at that point that we're really thinking about what can we do, because I think what we're not talking about yet is how can we empower students whose self-esteem is being challenged so much at such a kind of pivotal age developmentally.
Right. And the self-esteem is being challenged because of the medical diagnosis that sets them apart from their peers.
Right. So, you know, students that are in larger high school settings that can't kind of make it, can't hang with their friends, can't make it into the larger classroom settings because of some of the symptomology that they're having. And even in our one-to-one setting, you know, we want to make them feel successful, and there are times that we can do that, but then when they're missing school again, it's kind of this cyclical thing where they feel bad about themselves, they keep feeling like they're falling behind. So we're constantly trying to think of, well, how can we set up an academic program for them where they can feel successful, where it's meaningful, where they're learning, and they're not falling behind so much.
Right. Do you find that their parents understand the impact of the medical diagnosis on their sense of self?
I think they do, and I think, you know, a lot of our parents are really looking to talk about it and just haven't found the venue, which is
right.
Kind of part of why we're doing what we're doing tomorrow is because they need their own community. And I think, you know, hopefully Jennifer and Dr. Frid can share with them where they can find their own support networks, because I think it just hasn't been fully recognized in the medical world or in the educational world either.
Right.
That this is actually real and this is happening.
Yeah, and it's affecting so many children. The other piece that, sometimes I'll see is we've raised our kids in such a way that the children are really willing to talk about their issues, mm-hmm. about their struggles, about their diagnosis. They might even use the word, you know, I have this learning disability or this medical disability. And it's said without shame, because it's acceptable with the younger generation to discuss that we're not all perfect. But I've often in my practice, I'll see parents coming in and the parents don't, you know, very strict. We can't classify that as a illness or a problem or a disability. You know, they're very cautious that they don't want their child to identify themselves as somehow less than. But ironically, we've done so much good education with kids these days that children aren't experiencing it as less than. It's what makes me unique, and it's a part of me, and it's okay. And I can live with this, mm-hmm. and I have to take this medication, or I need to go for this special occupational therapist session, or this therapist appointment, or this MD appointment. And children are much more able sometimes than parents to handle that stress. On that note, what about meds? And Dr. Frid, if you would like to speak to this, we would welcome any input on, are there meds today for Lyme disease?
Yes, so as many of you know, Lyme disease is a bacterial infection. And so the way in my practice I choose to treat it is I initially identify all the infections that may be going on with the patient, which is what we touched on before, that more often than not, it's more than one infection occurring at the same time. And so we identify all the potential infections, and we treat them all at the same time with medication, which can be antibiotics or antiviral medication, depending on what, or anti-malaria drugs, depending on what infection we identify. And then, depending on the progress that we make, as I mentioned before, some of these patients can develop autoimmune issues. Again, that's when your immune system is attacking its own body. And we see that based on a variety of neurologic testing, as well as some specialty blood work, checking for antineuronal antibodies and things like that, that we can identify in the patient both clinically and through diagnostic testing. And if that's the case and a patient requires a support of their immune system, we treat that as well in conjunction with treating the underlying infection, which drives the autoimmune process. So that's how that's treated. And there are, of course, supportive treatments for different symptoms. So a lot of my patients come in with diagnoses, like you mentioned, learning disabilities, psychiatric diagnoses, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, intractable headaches, these kind of a collection of symptoms. So in my opinion, a lot of these diagnoses are really symptoms. They're not a true diagnosis. There's an underlying cause. And maybe not in all of these patients, but definitely in the large majority of these patients. And so we try to identify the underlying cause. And in the meantime, while we treat them, patients will require some, perhaps depending on what they have, medications for insomnia or depression or anxiety so that they can cope day to day in the meantime. And the treatment itself is different than what the CDC guidelines establish. There are two schools of thought as to how to treat Lyme disease. One way is the CDC guidelines, where 3 to 4 weeks of antibiotics are administered, and if a patient continues to have symptoms beyond that, it's believed to be a post-Lyme syndrome, and then only the symptoms are treated beyond that. And then there's the ILADS guidelines that call to the fact that we need to treat patients until their symptoms resolve, which is the protocol that I follow in my practice.
Okay, thank you very much for sharing that. And I'd like to just reach out to you, Jennifer Reed, in terms of commenting on some of what we're talking about as well.
Yes, Beth, I just wanted to reflect a little bit on what you said before about the way we've raised our children to really appreciate who they are and their disabilities. One of the things that's most unnerving about these tick-borne diseases developing at the high school or college level is that, as parents, what you're seeing is this is not who they are. They have not learned through those younger years, because for many of these children, some perhaps did have other disabilities, but for most of them, they were proceeding through school, their sports, their friendships, and really doing very well. They had very, very happy lives. They were scouts, and life was headed for college, and parents' expectation was that it was headed for college. And then they come down with Lyme disease, and sometimes it's a very slow unraveling, and it takes a long time to figure out what it is, and it also the children don't always even realize what's happening. They're terrified.
Right.
And so it's not that they can automatically, it's not that parents or educators even really know what to do. And sometimes as they're embarking for college, there isn't too much you can do. And for some of these children, it takes years to recover. So it's a little bit late for some of the self-esteem building that we try to do with children, because they were, I'm going to say, at the top of their game, and this really pulled the rug out from under them. And just getting the diagnosis and recovering can take quite a while. sports moves on, school moves on, they get left behind, friendships disappear, and it's really devastating for these children and for their parents.
Right. And I would assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the diagnosis later into adolescence would be even more difficult.
Oh, absolutely, because a bit much of the time it's written off as, teenage angst and just adjustment to college and stress and, the typical things. And
right.
Then parents realize it was none of the above. It was Lyme disease.
Yeah, there was something else going on. All right, thank you very much. You can register for the panel at www.linksacademy.org. This is Beth O'Malley at the Greenwich Sentinel Radio Hour on Be Well with Beth, WGCH 1490 and WGCH.com from anywhere.
You're listening to the station you grew up with, 1490 WGCH, Greenwich.
Defense Gear Travel Ban Review. I'm Chaz Henry. In Florida today, President Trump spoke for his first time as president to a military audience, promising service members at U.S. Central Command and Special Operations Command headquarters his administration would be providing necessary tools to the nation's defense force.
We're going to be loading it up with beautiful new planes and beautiful new equipment. You've been lacking a little equipment. We're going to load it up. You're going to get a lot of equipment.
Judges on a federal appeals court in California are today going over arguments related to the administration's presently halted travel ban. Correspondent Ariane DeVogue.
It's important to remember that no court has ruled squarely yet on the legal merits. No court has said this is constitutional or it's not constitutional. So far, all you've got is that one district court judge who's halted the executive order for now nationwide.
And Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch is meeting today with two Senate Democrats who could be key to his confirmation, Judiciary Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein and Montana Senator John Tester. I'm Chaz Henry. The NFL is packing up its show in Houston, thanking community members there for the role they played in the past week's Super Bowl activities. Correspondent Alan Skaya.
Commissioner Roger Goodell says more than 10,000 volunteers helped make the Super Bowl in Houston successful.
We just had an extraordinary week here in Houston, capped by maybe one of the greatest games of all time.
Minnesota Super Bowl host committee chief executive Maureen Bosch says billboards in her home state now have clocks counting down to next year's Super Bowl.
We're going north. So bring your parkas, and we will welcome you as warmly as you could possibly imagine.
Vikings players will also hold a rally at the Mall of America later this week.
In upstate New York, work crews are removing 5 to 8 feet of lake effect snow that's fallen on some areas since last week. The National Weather Service says it's measured 76 inches of snow in the town of Redfield and 66 inches in nearby Lacona. That's near the eastern end of Lake Ontario. I'm Chaz Henry.
A fast, easy way to get a great price on airfare. Isn't that what we're all looking for in travel? It's time you try One Travel. Convenience is key, from our quick download mobile app to great airline, hotel, rental car, and vacation deals at your fingertips instantly. You can even join One Travel Rewards and earn points to use on future One Travel purchases. Then get up to $20 off our booking fees on domestic flights by using promo code RADIO20. Call 888-898-2471 or go to onetravel.com. Promo code expires February 28, 2017.
This is Charles Osgood. Transition seamlessly from presentation to meeting and from work to home with the Dell Latitude 13 7000 series, the laptop that takes care of business. The powerful performance and incredible battery life from this reliable business-class PC featuring Intel Core processors let small business employees do their best work wherever work takes them. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio.
The films La La Land and Zootopia seem well positioned for the Academy Awards.
Here's to the mess we made.
Yet another sign La La Land is headed for a big night at the Oscars. The musical has been racking up prizes at the various Guild Awards, and Damien Chazelle just picked up the top prize from the Directors Guild of America. 60 out of 68 previous DGA winners have also won the Best Director Oscar.
Ready to make the world a better place?
Zootopia is looking good for Oscar night. The animated adventure about diversity and tolerance led the way at the 44th Annie Awards, winning 6 trophies, including Best Animated Feature. I'm David Daniel.
It was a half-baked effort at a bakery robbery in Delaware. Investigators say a guy with a gun got no bread when he tried to stick up a bakery in New Castle County. The woman behind the bake shop counter refused the gunman's demand to open the cash register. I'm Chaz Henry.
My number two does not look like a number two. I don't know what to call it. Is there a number three?
Table for four, please. Anything close to the restroom.
Ugh, a middle seat with these stomach problems? That's my fear of flying.
Sound like you? If it does, you could be one of the many people with a digestive condition called exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, or EPI. Even if you don't know what EPI is, you might know the symptoms. Frequent diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain. If you have even just one of these symptoms, you could still have EPI, because not everybody experiences EPI the same way, which is why it's so important to open up to your doctor about all your symptoms. And the good news is, EPI is manageable, so don't keep a lid on it. Go to identifyepi.com, complete the symptom checker, and use it to have a conversation with your doctor. Don't keep a lid on it. Visit Identify.
From the WGCH Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Dr. Bill Evans with your Doppler weather.